Artcast number 13, July 18th, 2005. Today, during our summer break, kind of something special. Not a new interview, but in this form, an unpublished one out of our archives. In the year 2000, Malcolm McLaren, maybe best known for his role as mastermind behind the punk legends Sex Pistols, Malcolm McLaren had an exhibition of his artwork in the Zentrum für Kunst und Medientechnologie ZKM in the German city of Karlsruhe. There, in Karlsruhe, I sat down with him, together with René Agiga, a reporter from the German newspaper Taz. You can imagine Malcolm McLaren in the year 2000. He was inspiring and provocative, as always. We were talking about the Sex Pistols, about his relation to Johnny Rotten, about the influence the Situationists, and especially Guy Debord, had on him, and his ideas about Napster. To make it short, Malcolm McLaren considered the inventor of Napster as a saint. But listen for yourself, here's the interview.
So what do you need to know?
First of all, I'd like to know one of your, three expressions in the title of your exposition, karaoke,
yeah,
authenticity, and casino.
Yes.
First of all, I'd like to know, why karaoke? What's for you so fascinating with karaoke?
It's just a word I use, and I think it's a word that's becoming common currency for a world we live in today where most people live a life by proxy. You know, we live in a world in which it is very product-driven. People don't like the messy process of creativity. That's what karaoke is about. Karaoke means mouthing the words of other people's and then not having to take any responsibility for it from the moment that performance ends. So it's a wonderful metaphor to describe the world we live in today, a kind of karaoke world, a world which is product-driven, a world that's about the commodification of a planet, a world that's about where everyone in it and everything in it that we produce is for sale, meaning there are no longer ideologies. There are no longer people who could claim they are not for sale. So in order to define this kind of new world we've entered, and it's not a world that suddenly happened, it's a world that's progressively happened, probably for the past 40 years or more. But we finally have arrived at a full-on commodification of the entire planet. And people have become less anarchic, less free-thinking. Everything appears in one way very stable, very normal. High culture and low culture have had their edges blurred. They've become one culture because everything has been turned into product. We live in a world of dilettantes, where dilettante was a word that was considered derogatory in a way if any artist was charged or accused, or even if someone who was working and working in more than one field was accused of being a dilettante. Today, to be a dilettante is de rigueur. It's very fashionable. Every contemporary artist, you could say today, is without question struggling to become a dilettante. You know, if it's Damien Hirst, he can be making a conceptual art piece today. Tomorrow, he can be opening a kebab house. The following day, he can be a TV comedian. I think that what's happening is this sense that you don't ever need any longer to be anything other than successful in the mediated world. So everybody is driven towards becoming part of the media. If you're not in the media, you are dead. You do not exist. So the art of celebrity and performance has become a kind of karaoke performance. No one's terribly sincere. It's all about faking it and making it and being part of a, what I think is a kind of karaoke style.
Are you sad about this? Are you...
No,
are you,
I think it's...
Conservative,
I think it,
of lost simplicity?
No, I'm not nostalgic at all, because nostalgia is nothing more than dead tissue. What I'm happy in a karaoke world is that it is, in some instances, very democratic. It is allowing everyone to be everything they want to be. The problem with it all is the only thing I don't like is the fact that it appears as if everything is for sale. And I think as soon as everything is for sale, everything becomes a commodity, including yourself, and you lose a sense of truth. You lose the ability to have an attitude that doesn't submit to a world that just wants to buy things. If you can, for one second, just draw back and become someone who can think freely, that person will immediately treasure his thoughts or her thoughts, and those thoughts won't necessarily be for sale. In this world we live in now, no one is even allowed to have such thoughts. There is no time to have such thoughts. You work, 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 work to buy, 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 buy more things, and you seem to be less and less and less satisfied with it. So there's a kind of thirst for a counterpoint to all of it, a kind of desire to look for what people believe is perhaps more authentic in their life, less karaoke. What is authentic? Authentic to me means to be true to yourself. How do you do that? I think what you do is you recognize the word failure as being rather noble. Suddenly, I would like to claim the fact that failure is a far more interesting word than success. Suddenly, I would like to tip over the balance of a world which constantly drives everyone to be successful and say, success is really boring. There's nothing very good about it at all. Failure is, in fact, very liberating. It suddenly says, if you claim to be a failure, you then have no fear of failing. If you have no fear of failing, you can think more freely. You can now be a lot more true to yourself. You're less governed by things. And there's a little piece of anarchy that can creep into your lifestyle, and suddenly you feel, I don't want to buy anything. I want it all for nothing.
Didn't we have this already? This reminds me of punk, in a way.
It's very much a punk rock attitude. Nothing's changed for me. I'm no less punk rock today than I was yesterday, than I was even before the word was born on the face of a particular music genre and style. Punk rock is basically about the noble pursuit of failure, you know? It has always been for me about making everybody an artist.
Because, I mean, don't you see that maybe, or don't you share the... what's your opinion, let's put it this way, what's your opinion to the statement that authenticity can also be something dangerous in the sense that there were wars fought about what's really authentic? I mean... Every fundamentalist claims to be more authentic than everybody else.
Well,
isn't there a kind of a dangerous thing with authenticity?
Anything that is true, anything that's going to change life, is dangerous. And anything that changes life, I personally embrace. I have always loved living a dangerous life. I've always loved criminals. I always think artists are criminals because artists change life. Artists are not liked any more in many ways than criminals. The best artists in the world we live in today are dead ones, because then they cause no trouble. They can be hung in museums like this. But if I turn around and say to you, Rembrandt, Van Gogh, Modigliani, and I say to you, they're all brilliant, magnificent, flamboyant failures. That's what makes them great artists. Because I think all art is about failure.
But you're just right in the museum right now. You're pretty alive.
Yes, yes. This is the irony. This is the irony in a world we live in where we have to somehow authenticate the karaoke. If you can put those two words together, which is what I think most artists have to do today, then maybe you can make something magical happen. So, and I think it's rather difficult to do. And I think any attempt at it will inevitably, in some respects, fail. And so designing my life like a casino was a brilliant metaphor, because if I could invite everybody to play my life like a game of chance, to reconfigure a group of fruit machines of one-armed bandits, the most cheating, horrible, ugly monsters on the edge of every pier, in every amusement arcade, in every little quaint seaside town, and I say, that's my life, I can also say at the same time, as you play my life, like a game of chance, you inevitably will fail. Occasionally, temporarily, you win something. And I thought that was the best way to actually create a metaphor for being here in a museum and for being an artist and for being someone who ultimately has lived a life of adventure. I think that in itself is my best idea for a self-portrait of my life and times. I couldn't think of putting a lot of photographs and very nice cerebral little films around the wall and have a nice text and everything. No, that would make out I was some kind of success. I guess last thing I could ever be considered as a success. I'm a ridiculous, brilliant charlatan who admonishes and administrates a life of flamboyant failures. That's what I am.
How come you choose these four phases for the themes of these four gaming machines?
Well, if you think of it like an odyssey.
Well,
if you think of it like an odyssey, if you go back to the very first adventure story, or at least one that we've managed to dig up in the ruins as we do, looking at other people's cultures, and you think of the Odyssey as an adventure tale, there's a mentor. There's always a mentor. There's always somebody that's going to tell you, don't walk that way. Walk this way. And you're very reluctant. You don't want to do it. And they tell you again. And they tell you again. And eventually, you may just decide to walk the other way. You become, by doing that, a reluctant hero. You go on a journey. That journey is a journey of several ordeals. In order, if you somehow get through those ordeals, battle, fail beautifully, you may be able to have the chance to return home and change life, life around you. So I took that odyssey that basic adventure tale, which is no different from The Gladiator that's on your screens right now this summer, or Indiana Jones 10 years ago, or any other adventure tale, Star Wars and so on. And I had to sort of treat my life as mentors. What are the mentors? Well, let's go back to the early days of my grandmother. Let's go back to the early days of my art school. Let's go back to the people who taught me about how to be bad. Because to be bad is good, because to be good is boring. Let's go and talk about art school, and let's look at all those mentors where I was taught, don't be successful. If you think you're going to be successful, leave now. Because you're going to now go on a journey of struggle, which inevitably you're going to fail. And I was taught that at art school, and I wanted a machine that showed you my origins, my raison d'etre, my mentors, my background. And I called it Erreur Fatale, because this is where I made, for all society to know, my fatal errors in life, my beautiful beginnings of living a life of failures. This is the machine called Erreur Fatale. On the trails, I designed myself a blue lamé suit when I left art school and walked down the King's Road and fell into a muddy hole in the wall and created a group of stores for the purpose of making them brilliant failures. This machine, which is mostly about my adventures in shopkeeping and the failures I had and the constant battle to not be successful, and every time that shop was a success, I would close it down and retitle it and rename it and do something else. And that machine's called The Boy in the Blue Lamé Suit. I then opened another door and thought, well, everybody, of course, knows me for having been involved in the creation of something the media dubbed punk rock. How could I show the origins of that? How could I show the story of that? How could I show that as part of the ordeal? How could I even relate that all the way back to art school and show punk rock as the most beautiful failure in which you turned a whole generation into a generation of artists who had no fear of failure? They could play anything, anytime, anywhere, in any way they so desired. I called that machine Sex Pistols, Young Sexy Assassins, and tried to set out to prove that you can make cash from chaos. Try to show that chaos is a beautiful word because it's where everything can appear possible. Finally, I had to show my own adventures on the seas, going off, steering a boat down into Africa, going off into the digging in the ruins of the worlds of Puccini and opera, finding guys who were turning, making music out of other people's music, hip-hop, a kind of black punk rock. And I called that part of a philosophy that again goes back to this sense of failure, do it yourself. I tried to make the culture no more than a DIY shop. I called it DIY. And those four machines make some vain attempt at throwing my life all around the walls as you access the machines and see my life in a chaotic melee of 1,000 fragments, all cut up, apparently thrown against the wall in no particular order, but just according to how you play the machines. And that somehow liberated me. It sort of suddenly made me one fabulous mess across this rather benign, old-fashioned munitions factory set up for the purpose of inviting you into this new world of media technology. How could I make it messy? How could I make technology a messy process? The messy process of creativity. How could I do that? So that's how I've tried to do it. for my life in shops and shopkeeping, I had to look at them as an authentic side of things. How could I show the authentic side rather than the virtual side through these machines? Well, I'm just going to make a series of graves. Graves that you could walk over. And as you walk over them, they can light up, and between your feet, peering down through the grates, you can see, just like you were digging up some Egyptian tomb 150 years ago, a few holy relics. And a Sid Vicious doll. An old punishment painting from my art school days, where I did a series of paintings that just wrote the words, "I will be so bad 100 times. I suspect also old door handles, an old boot, just stuff, bits, the crumbling ruins. And within it, pressed between glass, I looked at some of the figures I could create from that period of time, some of the anti-fashion statements I made in those shops, and see them as sort of ghostly characters, sort of suspended somehow in perpetual animation. And hopefully that was, again, a vain attempt at creating a self-portrait at that moment, but one that had a more authentic feel, because they were ruins. They were figures, ghostly figures or whatever. So that, set against the fruit machines, became for me a wilder, a much better, and certainly more, even more vulgar, flamboyant amusement arcade that I would like to see at the end of a pier near me. Okay. That's it, really. And if you win, and you can win things, if you get 400 points on the machine, which means you're going to have to stay on that machine a good 45 minutes, then you can take pleasure in going home with one of my artifacts from my past. Like that mayoral poster on the wall there. Or an old boot. My old pair of punk rock shoes. Or a t-shirt with Svengali written across your breasts, so every nice little 13-year-old girl can walk around looking for her Svengali. And such things. That's it.
Yeah. About the Sex Pistols. I don't want to ask you anything about the Sex Pistols. On the other hand, I want to ask you, what's the question you want to never ever have to answer again about the Sex Pistols?
Well, I don't, you know, the problem with the Sex Pistols questions that have haunted me for decades now is that very few people understand it to have been an art project. It was fine art at its very best. I was merely carrying out the task of those lecturers that taught me the noble pursuit of failure. I happened to convince a whole generation of those remarks made by that lecturer. I was just doing my job as an art student. I just went off and preached the very words I was taught. And somehow or another, it captured a whole generation and turned them all into artists for a brief moment. And I don't think they returned again to normality. It was saying, enter a special world, leave the ordinary one behind.
How would you describe your role? Is it the role of an inspirator? The role of an artist?
Well, I think in a way, I suppose, if I was to die tomorrow, what would I leave behind? A few crappy posters, a couple of old records? I would leave behind...
To the Sex Pistols.
Huh?
In relationship to the Sex Pistols. Your role, your relationship to the Sex Pistols.
In relationship to the Sex Pistols, I was, on one level, an artist. teaching art, really. Art as life. Life as art. Applying those principles that I said earlier. And sometimes, naturally, just like any artist, artists are manipulators. They're dangerous people. They're charlatans at times. They are criminal. I was all those things too. I manipulated, I was a criminal, I was a charlatan. And I tried to do it in the best possible way. I was an actor. I didn't manage the Sex Pistols. This is what people don't realize. What I did was mismanage, purposefully, dutifully, in order for them to fail magnificently.
Do you still have the phone number of Johnny Lydon?
Good God, no. Johnny Lydon would want to speak to me. Johnny Lydon hates me. All the Sex Pistols do in some kind of way, because I don't blame them. You know, it's like a sculptor. Instead of using clay, one used people and abused them. I've no question in my mind to ever repent that or to ever excuse myself from it. I did it, but I did it for the benefit of art.
Maybe one last question from my side now for this chapter. But I mean, if I think back to this time of punk rock, when I was maybe start of my 20s or somewhere there around, a little younger, I mean, there were people involved in this movement who really failed.
Mm.
And who, I don't know.
Well, the thing is, you see, if you fail, and this is the next really important point that I learnt in art school, you must not fail pitifully. You must not fail pathetically. You must only fail flamboyantly as possible. It's the opposite of being a benign success. And those that fail pitifully are just a pimple on the bum of punk rock. Those who failed magnificently are just the most brilliant boil, a cyst, a disease, incurable. That's the closest you're going to get to Rembrandt. That's the closest you're going to get to Paul Cézanne. That's the closest you're going to get to Modigliani. That's the closest you're going to get to the lifestyle of Diderot or Voltaire or Rambo or Jack Kerouac or William Burroughs, or, you know.
Just back to the relationship between Mr. McLaren on the one hand and Sex Pistols on the other hand. You just described yourself in this relationship as a manipulator and all that.
Mm.
On the other hand, how would you describe Sex Pistols, the band, as your material?
They were brilliant architects and aides to the noble pursuit. And they were innocent victims of it. And they were naturally going to be angry, as any innocent victim would be, of what they felt was arch manipulation. In the end, they felt a little duped. But that's only because they didn't have art lecturers like I had, so they never understood the full story, and they couldn't easily or always relate to it. It's perfectly understandable, you know. It's like, you know, well, they at the end of the day wanted to be rich and successful. They couldn't understand how I could keep them from just not doing that, but just almost trying constantly to fail. They got fed up with doing that, so they wanted to attack me. You know, this is not what we really entered this game for, Malcolm. You know, but on the other hand, I would always respond with, but you wouldn't be here doing it. You wouldn't even be loved, admired, and found inspiring if you didn't celebrate what I'm telling you. You would just be another one of those horrible pop cultural rock and roll bands that you've set out to destroy. You'd be an utter contradiction. You would be fake. And I'm not going to be part of that. And Rotten became my arch enemy because he couldn't and didn't really quite want it to end that way. And I understand that, you know. But the fact is, they all did. And I'm glad for it. Their pathetic revival of pretense to look as if they're failing, with champagne in the tents behind stage, was just ridiculous. It was just a contradiction in terms, you know. Like, what are you trying to say? You're now a circus act going round town. Let's touch the legend. Let's pay to touch the legend. Oh, bollocks. Bury the fucking legend, please. Make it a beautiful ruin. Don't pretend you're still these young, noble pursuers of failure. Don't start singing God Save the Queen and then, you know, pretending you're this successful rock and roll band. It just doesn't make any sense. You have been programmed to fail brilliantly and become the most noble artistic statement in pop cultural terms for a very, very long time.
So they are really comparable to material or to colors, to a page. They are material for your...
Well, they were, you know. Instead of using paints, instead of using clay, they were also like my gang of artful dodgers, straight out of the pages of Oliver Twist, and I played that role of Fagin. I was always brought up to believe that Fagin was a hero you should relate to. Listen, when it came to stage Oliver Twist and turn it into a musical, the actual poster says it all. They don't put Oliver Twist on the poster. They put Fagin. Doesn't that tell you something about the criminal? Is what excites you. It's what inspires you out of the story. No one cares about Oliver Twist. Everyone just loved the Artful Dodger. Of course. And everyone, therefore, wants to be the Artful Dodger. So, in a way, that's part of one's kind of heritage of anarchic pop culture. I always believe rock and roll bands should only be groups of artful dodgers. That's when they're exciting, when they're just playing music for music's sake. I just never understood that. But that's because I came from the world of the visual arts. I was bored always with just the music. It didn't mean enough to me. I needed the narrative, I needed the visual story, and I needed to turn the world upside down with it.
Just one last time, insisting on your role. Manipulator, artist, all those things. But wouldn't you perhaps prefer a word like a connector in a network rather than the sovereign?
Well, I was a catalyst. I was definitely a catalyst. I was definitely a catalyst, okay. Acting as a conduit for artistic ideas of terrorism, you know, to be an art terrorist, to actually change life physically in the real world. You know, you were basically creating a special world inside the real world. And you were bound to come up with a lot of problems. Most artists close the doors and do it all inside the confines of their room. They don't have to do battle with the real world. If you're suddenly taking real people and you're actually out on the street, then you're actually right in the front line and the heart and the mouth of the lion. And it's a bigger job, and you've got to be a smart guy to survive. And I barely did, but I carried on. My mentor forced me to carry on that journey, and I'm still here.
In some texts, you are related to this movement called the Situationists.
Well, that was a part of that. They were mentors of mine during the course of art school in the 60s. The Situationists were major mentors because they were able, as failed artists, to use political rhetoric, probably sometimes the most inarticulate rhetoric, difficult to understand, but there were certain phrases and certain attitudes that really spoke very clearly about the commodification of the planet, about the whole spectacle of the commodity and society becoming part of it and everyone in it merely an unpaid slave to it. You know, we live on the most expensive theme park in the planet and we're all just unpaid film extras in it. And I think the Situationists, everything they said, and they said that very clearly in the 60s, we didn't quite believe was happening because it hadn't quite happened. But the fact is today, I think everything the Situationists said has absolutely come true.
Guy Debord had this book here, The Society of Spectacle, expressively says in his foreword that his more or less only aim he has with this book is to do harm to the spectacular society. So am I right that you have similar aspirations in your art?
Yeah, he's one of my mentors. He's one of my mentors. When I helped put God Save the Queen at number one, and had it banned and not being able to be played on the radio at the same time, Guy Debord called me up on the telephone. I'd never spoken to him in his life, and he was, as you well know, a total recluse. He avoided any form of media involvement, but he called me on the phone, and he said, "Thank you very much for getting my record to number one." As far as he was concerned, he owned that record and owned that idea. And I thought, brilliantly audacious, and truly wonderful, and I never forgot it. I agree with him. It was his idea, yes.
I thought that I understand it right. Debord called you and said, "Thanks for putting my, Debord's..."
Record at number one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, turning things around.
Absolutely.
In several interviews, you express a kind of hope that a younger generation maybe one day will stand up and say, "You can't buy me."
Well, that's the big battle cry today. Today, we live in a world, as you know, that's mediated. We live in a world in which the entire culture and its politics will be defined and fought out on the internet. The internet will define this century's beginnings of its culture and its politics. There are two forces at work on the net right now. One force that wants you to buy everything, and another force who wants to give it all away for nothing. You have companies like Napster who are being taken to court because they've suddenly opened up the jail of all this archive of pop culture and said, "Hey guys, come on in, take what you want." And then there's these corporations who've decided, "Hey, but we own all this. You can't give this away." So, in fact, Mr. Napster, whoever he is actually a saint. He's a new 21st century saint. And this guy is breeding a very contagious disease amongst a new generation who for the first time now can question and have an ideology. Hey, whose pop culture is this? Is it the people's or is it multinational corporation property?
I mean, there's another, also on the net, there is this movement of, don't know if you know this, called open source software, which is software which people collectively...
P2P, person to person?
No, open source software.
Meaning?
You don't buy anything from a corporation, but if you develop something in a group, you give it out for free.
Right.
You don't only give it away for free as a product, but you give the source code with it.
Right.
And you allow people to take it for free and work with it. And the only obligation is if you improve it, if you change it, you have to hand it over for free again.
Oh. Fantastic.
To me, it seems like a very, very interesting.
As I'm saying.
Moment gaining.
Well, this. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what. That is, in effect, what I've just said. I think the battlefield will be. It will be corporations trying to control the net, and turn it into one big, vast shopping mall, and there will be others that are wanting to control the net and give everything away for nothing. Whoever wins that game will change the way this society will live for the next 50 years.
But very specifically asked, you produce some music. Would you go out there and say, well, just distribute it, I don't really care. I don't want to earn money from radio stations playing it. I don't want to earn money anymore from people buying my records.
Well, put it this way. If people want to buy it, then you're not going to necessarily be able to stop them buying it. If people don't want to buy it, you're not necessarily going to stop them not buying it. So it's an open-ended situation. I'd much rather see an open world where things are for free, but what's more important than that is where things are not for sale. That's the distinctive idea. That's where you can make failure brilliant, as I say. That's where you can turn into Rembrandt. Because if you're not for sale, then it's much more the ideas that you create currency, and they have a longer life. If you're just going to play cat and mouse with products, who cares? Hey,
excuse me. I just heard we have only 5 minutes to go, something like that. I'd suggest to turn to the short game. I suggested it would go like this. We are going to drop some words, and you are going to associate the words.
You go on then.
Yeah.
Okay.
In a rather fast.
Go on then. Go ahead.
Start with communication.
Communication. Communication, the first word, I think, is the internet.
Eloquent.
Eloquent?
You can...
Eloquent means, for me, somebody who speaks well, slowly, and commits me to action.
Germany.
Germany, a vast country of too many joyless people.
Switzerland?
Switzerland, a place to buy chocolate.
Hip-hop.
Hip-hop, a wonderful way of showing how you can steal other people's music and make something else with it.
Punk?
Punk, a great way to tie yourself up and demonstrate the chains that this society imposes on you.
Techno.
Techno, how to dance and possibly remove your head.
Dada.
Dada? The godfather behind the Nazi Party. The people who invented the media and didn't understand how it could be taken away from them and turned into something that the Americans after the war stole. The Dada really were the beginnings of artists understanding iconography, branding, propaganda, and being able to basically promote art as politics. It was something that Hitler took and turned into a spectacle. And by doing so, the Americans after the war were able to take that spectacle and realize they could colonize the world too without guns, just by selling Levi jeans, Hollywood, Coca-Cola, and later something they didn't really like, but something they realized was going to sell, rock and roll.
Okay,
and they took over the world.
Styles in arts and music.
Sorry?
Styles in arts and music.
Styles in arts and music. Well, style is a wonderful thing that's called fashion. And fashion stands between art and music because it's something that never really is about living in the present. It's always about living either in the past or living in the future.
If you had three wishes for pop culture today, what would they be?
Well, first wish is do not pray to it. Look down on it. Trample on it. Destroy it. And take from its ruins what you want and rebuild something better.
I have a lot.
Second wish about pop culture? Second wish about pop culture is to really understand very clearly that pop culture was developed out of the fact that every black man in the Deep South, having left the church, been beaten over the head, left the church, looked outside, sold his soul to the devil, and spent the rest of his life trying to buy it back. That's what pop culture means. That was the origins of rock and roll, and that's what turned it into an outlawed culture, and it's the reason why all of us little Anglo-Saxons constantly tried to imitate that very black man. That was the way we associated with the unliberated question. That's what gave rock and roll a political context that has now been submerged and turned into merely an artifact of complete worthlessness.
Well, I still have a lot of questions. Well, maybe you can answer on the short. What's today your favorite artist?
Today, my favorite artist? I would say today my favorite artist is the man that invented Napster.
What's your favorite musician?
Favorite musician? I don't have one.
What's your favorite color?
Favorite color? Deep blue.
Favorite dish? Dish. Favorite dish.
Favorite dish?
What do you like most meal. To eat? Meal. Your favorite meal?
Steak tartare.
Your favorite fashion designer?
Christian Dior.
Your favorite philosopher?
Diderot.
And favorite writer? Favorite writer?
Arthur Conan Doyle.
How and where are you living at the moment and why?
I'm living in London. I'm living in Soho, and I'm living there for reasons that blood is thicker than water, and sometimes you turn back and go home, but I'm ready now to leave again.
What can we expect next from Martin McLaren?
An explosion in the theatre world.
And my very last two questions. How does it feel to be Malcolm McLaren in the year 2000?
A real hard struggle to continually remain a flamboyant failure.
Is happening.